understand it too, in these words that I say, I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. Say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes.
Yeah, Riders on Writing every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific time. Yeah, the dirt on publishing, writers, authors, all of it. Listen.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome to this October 7th, 2009 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. You can visit the iTunes public radio page, or you can always visit Barbara's website at penonfire.com. There are quite literally hundreds of interviews posted there, including poet laureates, journalists, biographers, Pulitzer Prize winners, Booker Prize winners, huge gamut of writers. So I urge you to check that out. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Barbara and I are here each and every week bringing you live conversations with authors, poets, agents, and publishers. We're devoting ourselves to fiction this morning, and I'm here now with the very funny Jonathan Tropper. Coming up in the second half hour, Stuart Onan will be here discussing his latest novel, Songs for the Missing. Jonathan Tropper is the author of How to Talk to a Widower, Everything Changes, The Book of Joe, and Plan B. He lives with his family in Westchester, New York, where he teaches writing at Manhattanville College. He's currently adapting This Is Where I Leave You as a feature film for Warner Brothers Studios. It's published by Dutton. It is phenomenal, and I feel very privileged to be speaking with him this morning. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. I have to say, though, I'm hardly unique in observing this, that I really have not laughed this openly and often while sitting alone for a long time, probably since my last David Sedaris books. But I want to give you a chance to talk about the book, introduce it for those who haven't read it yet, and chat a bit about the inspiration for it for you.
Well, the book takes place over the 7 days that the Foxman family has come together to sit Shiva for their dead father and husband. This is a family that was not raised with any kind of religion, and they were very shocked that their father left this dying request that they come together and sit Shiva. There are four adult siblings who have not traditionally gotten along very well with each other, And it's really a trial for them to have to spend 7 days in the house they grew up with, they grew up in together, you know, along with their, you know, wives and husbands and kids. You know, but what the book is also about is one of the siblings in particular, Judd Foxman, who has just lost his wife. He just found out that his wife has been sleeping with his boss for the last year. So his marriage has just fallen apart. And while he's coping with all the implications of that, he's forced to come back and spend 7 days dealing with all of his long dormant issues concerning his nuclear family. So it's just a very combustible situation for him.
It felt sort of like The Big Chill meets Parenthood or something. I don't know. It was, well, it was fabulous. Did it start for you with Judd? Was he the, did it start with character or did it start with kind of plot family stuff?
I didn't have the premise of the family and the Shiva at all. It really, to me, I started the novel wanting to tell the story of this man who loses his, basically, his wife's been sleeping with his boss, so he loses his job and his marriage on the same day. And I wanted to tell the story of this man who loses pretty much the two things that he felt most defined who he was, his marriage and his career. Mm. And I wanted to tell the story of this man kind of trying to figure out at the age of 35 how to start over and what really makes him a man. And I wrote about 100 pages of that, and I happened to write one chapter where he went back to see his nuclear family for a birthday party for his dad. And as I wrote the characters of his siblings and their reactions to his situation, that was the first time the book really came alive for me, and those were the characters who really, you know, I enjoyed writing. And so at some point I made the decision to just scrap a lot of what I'd written before that and make the book about the Foxman family.
Actually, that's it. You know, it's interesting. If you're trying to write about somebody in a vacuum, I would think it'd be hard. You know, you're too much inside of their head. So, but what better way to get them out and moving than to, you know, trap them in a room with their family for 7 days? It just struck me as just the perfect setup for, you know, humor and conflict and all of it when you're literally, you know, locked in with your family for 7 days. I honestly can't imagine anything worse than that.
and really I stumbled upon it because my only goal in creating the family was just to further humiliate Judd. And I was like, you know, I wanted him to hit rock bottom, and I was like, what's the worst thing I could do to him? I know, I'll send him back to see his family. And it just worked so well, and the characters just came alive for me, and I ended up wanting to give them the whole book, so... You know, I basically had to convert Judd to Judaism, and I came up with the premise of having them sit Shiva.
You know, the thing that I mentioned in the introduction I want to talk about in writing humor, you know, it's just so darkly funny, which I think is kind of the best kind of humor for me. But I realized, though, that I was laughing not only because the scenes are you know, funny and a little outrageous, but because they pack such a deep and universal truth behind them, you know, about human nature and relationships and the rest of it, pain and loss. And I'm wondering if you view humor as the goal to make people laugh, or is it more in service of your goal to convey something deeper?
Well, what's interesting is I get asked that a lot, or some variation on that question. And the fact is, I don't really have a plan. I don't intend for the books to be that funny. I that's kind of how I write. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I get asked, you know, how do you sort of find that line of, you know, mixing humor with pathos? And the truth is, I don't look for the line. It's I don't know that I could write any other way. This is how I write.
That's great.
And so, you know, if I had to pick between, if it was a multiple choice test, I'd pick your second choice, which is that the humor is in service of the larger truths that I'm trying to convey.
Right.
But the fact is, you know, I don't plan for it to be a particular kind of funny. It just, you know, I do write with a certain voice, and that's how it comes out.
Can you is that something you think you can teach, or do you think that's just in the person?
No, I don't think you can teach voice. You know, I teach a fiction workshop at Manhattanville College in Purchase, New York, and I always say you can't teach voice any more than you can't teach someone to be funny. You can't teach someone to be smart. You know, people are who they are, and that's why you can't really teach someone to write. You know, writing comes from inside. All you can do is teach people how to refine it and how to make it better and how to be critical of their own work. But I don't think you can really teach you know, the innate aspects of writing. I think people either have an instinct for it or they don't.
Yeah, yeah. I'm speaking with Jonathan Tropper. His latest novel is This Is Where I Leave You. And the other thing that was interesting about the humor is that usually I think of, you know, the room being full of tension and the humor kind of steps in and saves the characters. And the interesting part of this is it felt like it was the reverse. It felt like the humor led the way and then kind of led the way into the pain or the, you know, psychological insight or something, and then you kind of ended on a poignant note. So it was kind of a reverse of how I usually read humor is going, and it was really nice, really nice.
Well, for me, like I said, it's not comic relief for me. I try to have the characters talk the way I imagine them talking, and, you know, these are, in particular, are characters for whom nothing is terribly sacred when they're with each other,
mm-hmm.
So they're capable of saying the most outrageously strange things in the middle of a really dark moment, you know, as opposed to lightening the moment, it actually highlights it in a way that most of us would never do out of either politeness or, you know, social propriety.
Right, right. That's the beauty of fiction, is that you can make your characters say things that you never would say in real life and watch
exactly.
It play out, which is
great. It's totally wish fulfillment.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that struck me is that you had such a large cast of characters, and it didn't hit me when I was reading it, but when I looked back over it and realized how many people were in play, you know, four siblings and spouses and children and girlfriends and ex-girlfriends and lovers and neighbors and landlords, it looked overwhelming in hindsight, but it never felt that way. And I was, you know, everybody's role was kind of strictly defined. Was it difficult for you to keep all the character plates kind of spinning in the air at the same time?
Well, yeah, but you have to realize you read the finished product.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot that goes on. There are characters who I start out writing and, you know, 200 pages and realize I've got nowhere for them to go, so I remove them. And, you know, I definitely, you know, make mistakes along the way and have to figure things out as I'm going. And sometimes I'm more successful than other times. And, you know, every once in a while you paint yourself into a corner with a character who, you know, halfway through the book or three-quarters of the way through the book, you realize you don't really have a plan for anymore because he's served his purpose, and now you sit there wondering, well, what do I do with him?
Yeah.
And that stuff, you know, that's the editing process, and that's sort of the price I pay for not really working with an outline.
Right.
Is that occasionally I do have to go back and refigure people's roles in all of this, and that sometimes means removing them, and that sometimes means kind of recreating them in another manner.
So tell me about that. You don't work from an outline. So you start with what, and you go where?
Yeah, I start with a voice. I know in my head who my first character is and what their journey ought to be. So I always, even though I don't know what's going to happen to them exactly, I know kind of what the journey I want to take them on is, and I generally have a pretty good idea of where I want to see them at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got that one character's arc. That's what I start with. And then I sit down and I just start, you know, writing, kind of trying to create voice and situation and conversation and, you know, get that character really strong on the page.
Yeah.
And as that happens, I introduce other characters who may or may not last. And at some point, usually around 40 to 50 pages in, I sit down and, you know, sort of see the mess I've gotten myself into. And that's when I do start doing a tentative outline. And I write an outline that's just basically a bunch of ideas of different type of chapters and how I'd like to move it forward.
Mm-hmm.
And very often the very act of writing that outline gives me ideas. Mm-hmm. Just the act of sitting at the computer and physically writing an outline, you know, it's a very free-form outline. And the outline sometimes ends up being 7 or 8 pages of just my rambling thoughts. And that gives me the, you know, some sort of loose blueprint to go forward for another 50 or 100 pages, at which point I have to throw it out and write another one. So throughout the book, I'm constantly writing and discarding these sort of free-form outlines as I make my way towards the end.
The hard part seems, you know, in a novel, you know, where you've got 300 or 400 pages of the forest from the trees, and, you know, trying to see where you've been, and especially if you're extracting characters or, you know, reworking characters, and, you know, kind of the pacing and when to release information, and, you know, how to drop foreshadowing and all of that. So in your revision process, maybe you can talk about your revision process a little bit. If you go back and reread things as a whole to massage it, or how you...
Yeah, well, what I try to do is once I have finished, I try not to look at it for a little while.
Uh-huh.
And then I'll look at it again and I'll decide, you know, this is a great passage, but I don't like this whole chapter here, so I'm going to get rid of the chapter, but I'd like to save this passage and find another place to work it in. Or I will say, you know, this revelation happened much too soon. The suspense would be greater if we didn't know this until here. And then, of course, you say, but to do that, I'm going to have to change the following six other things. And you get lazy, but then you have to force yourself to do it. So I go through that process once or twice by myself before I've ever handed in my book.
Uh-huh.
Once I hand it in, then I get the feedback from my editor who might have other ideas on it. And, you know, I'll sit down and look through it, you know, kind of with his eyes and see what he saw. And, you know, after having spent the last year alone with this, you know, having someone else's, you know, eyes on it is tremendously helpful and usually pretty eye-opening. So
yeah, indeed. You know, the one thing that felt like it helped us, so first of all, it had a very defined structure by having the 7 days, and it was divided up by the 7 days, so that feels like it would probably help. And
oh no, that's a killer.
Oh, that was a killer.
I thought that too when I started. I thought, great, I'll frame it over 7 days, and that'll solve all my problems. First of all, it's very hard to continue to build, you know, narrative arc when it's so episodic.
Ah, interesting.
You know, when you write a book, you know, it's the classic model. You want to kind of, you know, start with, you know, introduce the character, start with the conflict, complicate everything, and then reach the height of that, hit the climax, and then, you know, bring it home.
Right.
But when you're having things happen on 7 days, it becomes somewhat episodic. And the biggest challenge I had was when I had to move things around was figuring out how to fit them into which day.
Oh, interesting.
And then somehow keep a dramatic build going.
Right, right.
You know, and now that, you know, I'm in the process of adapting it as a screenplay, which needs that even more than a book. It needs that sort of three-act structure.
Yeah.
You know, rearranging all this stuff has been really difficult.
Yeah, and I want to get to that as well. I guess the other part of that too is trying to figure out how to weave in backstory and when the backstory isn't feeling forced and when it's right to release.
Exactly. I mean, the easy part about backstory is it can kind of come anywhere. It doesn't affect your narrative timetable, but on the other hand, it can't feel stuck in or, you know, wedged in between two plot points. You have to have, you know, very organic ways of revealing it.
Right, right. I'm speaking with Jonathan Tropper. His book is This Is Where I Leave You, and it's phenomenally funny, poignant read. I also want to talk to you about writing sex and sex scenes, because I think that's kind of complicated for writers. You know, there's so many kind of cliche ways of going about it, and, you know, all the standard, you know, nouns and verbs get used. And this was, again, with your humor and your voice so well done. Is that also a very natural thing for you? Did those take, I don't know?
Yeah, well, the way I look at it is, you know, people talk to me about the sex scenes, but if you read the books, I'm not writing them like sex scenes. I'm basically writing them like a conversation or like a fight. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm writing them the same way I would write a particularly tricky or funny conversation, which is, you know, there's two people here, what's going on? And, you know, people have told me they seem graphic, but they're really not graphic.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you read Updike and you read Philip Roth, there's some graphic sex there. I don't write graphic sex. I don't write about sex organs and, you know, penetration and things like that. I write about, you know, people, you know, almost, it. I don't stop it before they have sex. I write about the sex, but I write about the sex really from an almost comically intellectual perspective.
Yeah.
And as a result, you know, I don't find it uncomfortable to write about, although, you know, I am somewhat brutally honest about my characters while they're having sex and what they're thinking. And, you know, I try to be very realistic about that, because it's not like, you know, it's not violins playing and everybody losing themselves in the moment. You bring every piece of baggage you've got with you into the bedroom. And, you know, I don't like it when writers kind of either fantasize sex or fetishize sex or cheat you out of sex. I think you have to just go into it the same way you go into everything else, trying to be very realistic and very honest to it.
Yeah, yeah. And you indeed accomplished that. It was really, really great. Was it hard to, at any point, to stay in first person? Was there any temptation to sort of want to tell the story from somebody else's perspective?
Well, it was also because, like you said, there are a number of characters here, and I would have loved to leave Judd at some point and follow some of them for a little while by themselves.
Yeah.
The temptation was there, but I felt this was really Judd's book, and he was going through a very difficult and intimate time, and it just seemed like he also seemed, because he was so stripped of all his filters at this point, he seemed like the best person to look and describe everyone else.
Yeah.
So I did stay with him. It did limit me a little bit, but I think the payoff was worth it, which is that, you know, you have this kind of desperate, angry, sad, horny man describing everything and everyone he sees to you. So.
Yeah. So great. And I do want to talk about adapting it to the screenplay, because one thing, and I assume this comes from your screenwriting ability, is the dialogue is so great. And I think a lot of people struggle with dialogue and trying to make characters sound distinctly different from each other and, you know, authentic and all of that. I assume screenwriting helps you hear
well,
that.
Well, yeah, except it didn't happen that way for me. I wrote, you know, 5 novels, and I'm only now getting into screenwriting.
Okay.
You know, I'm not somebody who's long done both. I think one of the reasons I've been drawn to screenwriting and why people have been willing to give me a chance and hire me for it is because I've always had just a very strong ear for dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I really enjoy writing, and it's something I spend a lot of time editing. After I've written conversations, I go back, you know, in the editing process over and over again, looking for a false note, for a false beat, for, you know, anything that could be said with a little more wit, with a little more sharpness, with a little more verisimilitude. And I read the conversations out loud to myself, and I make sure they sound, you know, both true to the characters and true to the world that they're set in.
Yeah. Do you, study it by, you know, sitting in Starbucks and listening to people, or do you, I mean, are there tricks and things that you use to get voices for characters?
I don't think so. I think it's just, you know, it's just, you know, I imagine the character and I imagine how that character talks, and I'm sure the people, both the people I meet, excuse me, and the people, you know, and the characters I see on television and movies, you know, influence the way I look at dialogue, but I don't ever consciously find myself studying a particular person's manner of speech.
Okay.
I do remember years ago when, you know, like Aaron Sorkin, you watch Aaron Sorkin shows or plays, and he has a real rhythm of how his characters speak. But that wouldn't work well in my books. And that's, to me, it works for him in his world. But in my world, where I try to have people speaking, you know, in a more real way, it would feel like patter.
Yep.
And I'm not interested in that.
Right.
Which isn't to say that he doesn't do it brilliantly. It's just, it wouldn't work for me.
Not your style, right.
Right.
And tell me about adapting it for the screen, and that process of taking a novel with all its kind of, you know, complexity and expository, because a lot of this, it really is Judd's interior thought and,
right,
you know, observation on the world.
Right, none of which makes it into a film.
Right.
No, it's challenging. It's challenging adapting someone else's book, and it's challenging for other reasons adapting your own. The hardest part about adapting your own book is, you're not seeing it with a newcomer's eyes. You're seeing these people that you've already lived with for a number of years. And you're seeing, you know, it's hard to, you have certain preconceptions of what belongs there and what doesn't. And you don't even think consciously about the fact that, you know, I'm struggling on this point for so long. The truth is, this doesn't need to be in the movie. But it takes a while till that occurs to you, because it was such a fundamental part of the book, it would never occur to you that doesn't need to be there.
Right.
And so you have these moments of epiphany where you're like, you know, oh, I don't even need that whole subplot. I can just throw the whole thing out, and it's liberating. And, you know, at the same time, you're sometimes, you know, you're sometimes sad to see things that you really loved in the book disappear.
It would be a challenge to, you're right, to have lived with these people. Maybe it is easier to adapt somebody else's where you don't feel as kind of connected or emotionally invested in the storyline as you do with your own work.
Yeah, and it's hard, and the thing you just keep reminding yourself is that, you know, your book will always stay your book.
Yeah.
You know, pulling it out for the movie in no way changes your book.
Right, right.
And hopefully the movie will get a lot more people to read your book. So.
Yeah, indeed. Sadly, we're drawing down on the clock, but I wanted to give you time to share advice or wisdom from a writing perspective, either, you know, what you tell your own students or things that you've gleaned from over the course of the novels and screenplays.
Well, you know, the advice I tend to give when I get asked by aspiring writers is basically that I think assuming a baseline of talent, the only difference, you know, between those who get published and those who don't get published is perseverance, is being willing to, A, rewrite and make it as really as perfect as you can and not just be so dying to submit that you don't want to go back and look at it another time and take another pass and, you know, refine the things that you know in your heart need refining or editing.
Yeah.
And it's the willingness, if you're unsuccessful landing an agent or selling a book, it's the willingness to go back and write another one and not say, oh, I tried and failed. You know, I wrote a book before my first book got published that nobody was interested in, and, you know, that after I failed to sell it, I sort of took my time to grieve, and then I sat down and wrote a completely new book and accepted the fact that not everything you write and not everything you love is necessarily going to be, you know, something people want to buy. And, you know, your willingness to keep editing and revising and sometimes to simply throw out and start again, and then your willingness to keep getting rejected and keep submitting, ultimately, if you're willing to keep doing that, and you know, assuming, like I said, a baseline of ability, I do think those are the people who ultimately get published versus the people who give up or submit sporadically.
Do you think that second book and all the books that followed would have happened without that first failed, I shouldn't call it a failed novel, but without the one that didn't get published, do you think that sort of gave you the platform to jump to the next level?
I don't know. I think that that I look at the first one now, and I understand why nobody was interested in it, and I wouldn't be interested in it. And I think the growth that comes from recognizing you've written something that's not up to the level and being willing to try again and learn from that mistake, I think that growth definitely helps you.
Yeah.
But you have to have that sort of brutal honesty with yourself to say, you know, this is not good enough, but I think I can do better.
Yeah. Yeah. Jonathan, this was a huge treat. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I should also mention that Jonathan has a great website, jonathantropper.com, that has more information about his books and the screenplay and the rest of it, and just a fabulous book. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Stuart Onan will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we will be right back.
Come back, baby. Don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, ache and tears. Gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Thank you. darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Your attention, please. This is required listening information for all KUCI 88.9 FM radio frequency and KUCI.org broadband recipients. Weekly signals with Mike Kaspar and Nathan Callahan, a one-hour irreverent reality-based mashup of contemporary events, commentary, and interviews, broadcasts every Tuesday beginning at 8 a.m. sharp. You may choose to listen to Weekly Signals Weekly Review, Seymour Hersh, Garrison Keillor, Terry Jones, and Ariana Huffington, to name a few, on demand online at weeklysignals.com or live during the Weekly Signals Tuesday morning 8 a.m. time slot. However you choose, your listening is required. Again, that's KUCI Weekly Signals, Tuesdays, 8 a.m., and so on.
Listen to Writers on Writing every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit the iTunes public radio page or Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for more details on that. Stuart Arnan has written well over a dozen works of fiction and nonfiction. Both as a novelist and a short story writer, his award-winning fiction includes Snow Angels, The Speed Queen, A Prayer for the Dying, and The Last Night at the Lobster. Grant had named him one of America's best young novelists. He's a graduate of the Cornell MFA, and his latest novel, Songs for the Missing, is his latest work of fiction. It's published by Penguin, and Stuart joins me this morning from Connecticut. Stuart, welcome.
Morning, actually from Pittsburgh.
Oh, from Pittsburgh. Well, I'm sorry.
Yes, I've moved back to Pittsburgh, my hometown.
Oh my gosh. Well, that's perfect. That's it. Yeah. So before we dive into the novel, you have this wonderful timeline on your website where you talk about your evolution from engineering to writing, and you know, I won't make you recount the whole timeline here, but but I'm wondering if you can talk just a little bit about the journey, kind of your journey into writing, what inspired it. And perhaps what you draw from in your prior life that helps you now as a writer.
Well, I think it all comes from reading, and I've always been just a voracious reader, and someone that sort of haunts the libraries and the used bookstores. And you know, I was reading for a long time. I never thought I'd become a writer, but when I was working as an engineer, I found myself going home after work and just trying to put together stories and learn what is a story, how does a story work, and all the sort of my early influences came from the stuff that I read when I was a teenager, which was Ray Bradbury and Stephen King and Harlan Ellison, and I sort of mixed in some more literary influences like Joyce and Wolfe and Ford Madox Ford, people like that, as my sort of, undirected reading progressed. Mm. And it was only, I think, after I got to Cornell and I had people turn me on to people that I hadn't read. I mean, when I got there, I hadn't read Margaret Atwood. I hadn't read people like Alice Munro or William Maxwell. And those people sort of just opened up, other sort of avenues to go down.
Yeah, interesting. I was talking with a writer last week who was a doctor, and he was talking about how writing is really, in a lot of ways, kind of like a puzzle box or a math problem or math equation where you kind of have to fit the pieces together in just the right way and tell the story from different angles. And I don't know if you can draw on anything from the engineering background that translates into writing or, perhaps just the discipline of sitting down every day and doing it. But
Well, I think engineering versus, say, you know, pure science like physics, engineering always looks at the complexity of the real world.
Mm-hmm.
It has to think ahead and say, well, what could possibly happen if we do this? I think when you're thinking about fiction, you do that as well. You know, whenever I'm really, really stuck with a character at any point, I say, well, what would really happen? What would really happen to this person? Even if you're in some sort of fantasy world or, you know, somewhere else, and every world has its own sort of laws and rules, and every character has their own sort of, you know, desires and fears.
Yeah.
And when you say, what would really happen, then sometimes you can sort of, you know, inch forward a little bit and find out. But it's pretty murky. It's pretty mysterious when you get in there.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Yeah, it's interesting to kind of track the trajectory of your writing career, because you did a lot of kind of horror sci-fi stuff, right?
Earlier on? I don't know. I don't think so. I think I began sort of as a literary story writer, but I always sort of... I tended to include or at least play with some of the, some of the conveniences of plot or storyline that come out of the heavy story tradition of, you know, horror writing or sci-fi writing or just adventure writing. And I liked blending those two together.
Yeah.
Because at the time there were just sort of a lot of atmospheric short stories out there, or the little epiphany story where there was that little hiccup of emotion at the end, and then the minor chord ending, and that was sort of the industry standard when I came in.
Right.
And I like getting back to that heavy, wild storytelling where, you know, big things happen, or there are big consequences that lead to other consequences and dire consequences. And so I look back at people like, you know, Faulkner or Flannery O'Connor, or Tim O'Brien, you know, big stuff would happen.
Yeah.
And I think I've calmed down a little bit since then, but some of the first stuff was pretty showy.
Yeah, this was a very, you know, it was a sensational idea and a very quiet novel. So I want to get into that. So I'll give you a chance to introduce this for listeners who haven't read Songs for the Missing, to talk about it a bit and tell us about your inspiration for it.
Well, it's a story about an 18-year-old girl in a small town on Lake Erie up in Ohio, and she goes missing. And we follow the people closest to her, her mother, her father, her sister, her best friend, and her boyfriend. And basically the story is what they need to do to sort of, you know, to try to find her, and how that quest, I guess, changes their lives over the next few years.
Yeah, it was, like I said, it was so interesting to me because it was so kind of quiet, you know, the... It felt like you could overly emote, or you could really kind of, you know, drag on the heartstrings a lot, and it didn't do that. I thought it showed such gorgeous restraint. I don't know. It was just a very charged situation, and yet it dealt with it in such kind of a delicate, quiet way. Was that? Tell me about your initial area of concern when you got into it. Was it more? I assume it was more character-driven for you.
Well, I mean, I think everything is. I mean, when I started thinking about, you know, this particular person and the people around her, I had to figure out, you know, who they were, where they're from, what they're made of, and how they would respond, because everyone's going to respond differently, I think. And it seemed to come through, at least in the parents, they're relatively conservative, very staid, kind of pillars of the town, but, you know, the town's fallen on hard times. But they're very conservative. I mean, there's no question that they're going to stay together, that they're going to stay in the town and all that. I didn't worry too much about, you know, overstepping or under-emoting or anything like that. I just try to stick close to the characters and say, what would it really feel like to them?
Yeah.
And again, I wanted to move away from sort of the... what's the word for it? The conventions of storytelling and back to real life.
Yeah.
And almost a super, you know, hyphen naturalism there to bring it back and say, you know, we can't tell it as this is a fun thing where you have to hit plot points and satisfy a reader here and there.
Right.
It's get inside the characters and give that sort of that inner feel. So there are a lot of one-person scenes in the book. There's a lot of, it's sort of like French cinema. You know,
yeah,
there's a lot of you know, wondering about oneself,
yeah.
I think, and how one relates to the rest of the world, and it's a book of interiors in a way.
Yeah, it really
and
is.
And that decision probably saved it from being, you know, an Oprah-type book.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, it just felt like there were so many places where you could kind of fall into the way the story has been told before, and none of those traps, I don't know if you view them as traps, but none of those felt like, you know, the route you chose to take, which was really kind of nice and refreshing. And tell me about getting into character. This has a lot of shifting points of view. You write women, I think, incredibly well. There were a lot of female characters and writing from their perspective. Tell me a little bit about your process for mining character and kind of living inside these people's heads. And if you stay with one character for a long period of time before you switch to another one, or if you kind of, you know, jump back and forth between them, how that works.
Well, I like to go, you know, deep into character, and I keep notebooks on characters and think about, you know, what their desires are, what language they would use, who are their friends, who are the people close to them, what are the difficult relationships that they have, and what do they spend their time doing, you know, where do they work, what do they do, you know, where do they hang out. And I keep those notebooks sort of compulsively throughout the writing of the book. And so when I'm with one character for, say, 25 or 30 pages, which can take me, you know, 2 months to write, I'll be in their head and I'll sort of carry that character around the outside world with me. I'll sort of wear their mask wherever I am, and that helps me sort of pick up, see the world the way that they would see it. It's kind of like, I guess, method acting.
Mm-hmm.
You know what?
Mm-hmm.
Keep them as close as you can. And then when you jump over, you go back to the notes for this other character that you're jumping into, and you try to put their mask on for. And sometimes it takes a little bit to make that jump, to make that, you know. I mean, if you're in, say, Fran's character, the mother's character, and then jumping into JP, the boyfriend's character, their emotional investment in what's going on is completely different.
Right.
And the way that they see things and the way they see themselves and the town and the future and everything is completely, completely different. But I like that. I'm drawn to that sort of, you know, jumping from one subjective, you know, third-person character to another.
Yeah. Now tell me more about the notebook.
Sometimes I have to force myself to stay in one character for a long time to get deeper and deeper into them. And sometimes I'll do that, you know, after I've written a book with a lot of characters in it that I'm narrating from, I'll say, okay, I'm going to stick with one person and go as deep as I can for like 300 or 400 pages. And usually that, you know, that's you sort of spiral down to the character and you really, really get maybe too far into them.
I love that. Were there any that gave you any particular problems where you couldn't quite figure out their motivation, or after a while you just didn't like them, or were there any ones that were problematic for you?
No. In this one, I know that readers have sort of not liked certain characters and liked other ones because they always pick their favorite. Whenever you jump cut from one to another, they're always going to pick their favorite. But no, I liked all of them. I felt for all of them. I felt bad for all of them. I felt bad for the reader. but no, they all seem very fascinating to me, but some seemed more fascinating than others. And I think in the end, Lindsay, the younger sister, was the most fascinating for me, because I found all this stuff in her that I had no idea was there. At the beginning of the book, you think, oh, I might have a grasp on this character. And no, she completely sort of eluded me and kept sort of moving away and going in different directions that I had no idea she was going to do, which was kind of interesting. Also, Nina.
Yeah.
Nina went in a whole different direction than I thought that she was going to go. But that's what happens. You begin to sort of, you know, mesmerize or hypnotize yourself into these characters, and you begin to believe that they have this, you know, this agency.
Yeah.
Go off in their own directions. But of course, I mean, it's a trick. You're tricking yourself the whole time. But if you trick yourself long enough, and for this book it was, I think, two and a half years, you really begin to believe in them.
Yeah.
The trick works. And you hope that, you know, if you believe in them and care about them, then the reader will believe in them and care about them.
Right. Right. Now, I'm curious about, you know, it just strikes me as, excuse me, difficult to inhabit, you know, as a grown man to inhabit a teenage, I found it hard to inhabit a teenage girl when I was a teenage girl, so to inhabit that kind of mindset, is this a function of, you know, kind of hanging out with these kids at this age and hearing them talk and hearing their areas of concern, or is it just completely fabricated from your own kind of, you know, subconscious?
Well, I mean, nothing's a complete fabrication. I mean, you steal stuff wherever you can.
Yeah.
You grab it out of the air when you hear it. And at the time, my daughter was probably, when I started the book, she was probably about 20 or 21. So she was a little past that age. My son was younger, and he had friends, and occasionally I'd sort of listen to them and hear them. But, you know, it's just, you know, observations and, you know, stuff I picked up, you know, over the years. And, you know, and I was teaching college for many years and, you know, dealt with people in that age group.
Oh,
and, you know, at one point, believe it or not, I was a teenager. So, you know, I mean, you try to weave together everything you've got, you know, that memory and imagination and just transcription from life. And then, and sometimes, I mean, you connect with a character and you get that character. And that's the joy, I think, of fiction, in both reading it and writing it. You come to know these people better than you could ever know other people in real life.
Yeah.
You can really hang out with them and spend a lot of intimate time with them. You know, and that's the great privilege. So in the end, you end up having to know this character better than, you know, anyone would know anybody else. So in what you know of them, you only use a little fraction of it, actually, on the page. And so your notebooks are just filling up with all this stuff about the character, so you know them, you know, very, very deeply. And you only share, you know, so much of that with the reader to give that reader that sense, and also give the reader some space to add their memories and to add their life experience to it, because you want to leave room for them to sort of join the book and join the character.
Right, right. I'm speaking with Stuart Onan. His latest book is Songs for the Missing. Tell me more about the notebooks and how you organize them. And are they sort of like scrapbooks where you keep photographs and diary entries, or are they just kind of notes to yourself, or how do they look?
Well, they're notes. I mean, they're just basically notebooks, and there's usually six or seven different sections in them. There's one for every character.
Okay.
Gets, you know, a large section. A dog will get a large section. The town or the setting will get a large section. And I'll have, you know, one section will be sort of notes on the construction, and including, you know, lists of scenes that I think I really need to fit these in there. I really have to do a scene that does this. I need to do a scene that does that. There has to be a scene between these two people. And, you know, again, sometimes that stuff makes it into the book and sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, I always sort of have it there. And I also have, you know, lots of pictures. I do lots of sort of location scouting when I can. In this case, it was set near the real town of Conneaut, Ohio, up on Lake Erie. And so I drove around town and, you know, took shots of lots of houses and, you know, beaches and, you know, the downtown area, and stopped and talked with people. You know, any time that you can do sort of, you know, firsthand research like that, it's got to enhance the book, I think, and you get a little more flavor to it.
And did you have to spend...
So I'll have those pictures sort of hung up all over the place. And, you know, I'll look at them from time to time. And, you know, just it keeps you in that mood. You know, mood and direction. I think when I'm writing, because I don't really use plot much anymore. So for me, it's just mood and direction. What is the mood of the character? What direction do they seem to be going emotionally? From what emotion to what emotion, and through what, you know, what process or what, you know, what ordeal do they have to endure?
Yeah, interesting. Did you have to spend much time with policemen and police procedure and kind of that whole aspect of it to ferret out what happens during these investigations?
No, not too much, because I wanted to see it from the people that don't have access to that. I wanted to see it from the people that, you know, are wondering, why aren't the cops doing more? And it's always through the parents' eyes or through the friend's eyes or through the sister's eyes. So, I mean, they're kind of in the dark. They don't know. And that's what the book is. Throughout the book, I think, starting out, it's about not knowing and how terrifying it is not to know what's happened to someone that you love so much.
Yeah.
And in the end, I think the book turned into being about the terror of not being known.
Yes.
Not being known by the people that are closest to you. And that's certainly, I think, what happened with people like Nina and JP and certainly with Lindsay.
Yes,
That terror of being sort of left alone to your own emotions and your own feelings that you sometimes don't want to share with others.
Right, right.
And that's the saddest thing about the book, I think.
It is, yeah, you're right. So, yeah, it's so interesting. The other thing that I thought was interesting was which scenes you choose to tell and which scenes you choose to kind of leave to the reader's own interpretation. There was a great scene about Fran shopping for Christmas and the upcoming Christmas, and a lot of emphasis put on that. And then there wasn't, and the Christmas scene was not included on the page. And I thought that was such an interesting choice, because you're with her during kind of the quiet, incidental moments, but you're not with her during the, you know, spotlight moments that you think you would, and all of the things that your brain fills in for you when you're not there, I thought was kind of just as interesting as what was included. Were those hard choices to make, or were they kind of organic?
They seem like natural choices to make. And again, I mean, you always have to say, you know, what does the reader expect? And how do you satisfy the reader's expectation without simply delivering exactly what the reader would put together? So you want to stay at least one or two steps ahead of the reader. I mean, Eudora Welty always says that the best secret is the secret that the reader doesn't know.
Yeah.
So when you go into a scene and the reader knows a secret and thinks, oh, this secret's going to be, you know, suddenly, you know, given to us, you come up with something else. And the reader is just as satisfied, if not more, because they're not just given sort of the pat answer.
Right.
There. And plus, you know, throughout the book, I mean, it's based on, I think, these quiet moments alone, when the characters have to come to grips with how they're feeling about what's going on, and again, how they're going to get through it, how they're going to endure it.
Exactly.
And so when Fran goes shopping for, you know, basically for Kim's Christmas present, even though it's been months since they've seen her, I mean, I think she understands that she's fooling herself, but she has to do this. She has to keep going in it, and that sense of mission, even though the mission has somehow been lost, kind of defines her.
Yeah. So interesting. Did you know the end? I don't want to talk about the ending or give anything away, but did you know the kind of arc of the novel before you started writing it and how it would end before, or was it a matter of just kind of writing into the blindness and not knowing what happened?
This one was definitely writing into the blindness. I knew I had that sort of that, what's the word for it, that that imbalance that sort of sets everything in motion. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, when Kim sort of, she disappears basically in the first, you know, 6 or 7 pages of the book. And then it's, you know, what is going to happen? What naturally would happen? What do these people have to do? Who steps up? Who changes? How do they change? I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that I had, you know, a good setting, and thought a lot about the characters before I even got to the page. And I think that first few scenes between Lindsay and Kim and how they don't quite get along, and when Kim is sort of, you know, teaching her how to drive, even though she's annoyed by the whole process, and they're driving around this small town, and we know that Kim is going to leave for college and is going to leave Lindsay behind. I think right there, that sort of just set the tone for the entire book there. And at that point, I knew I had something that I could really sort of work with.
Yeah. Your sense of scene setting is just really incredible. I haven't set foot in Ohio or Pennsylvania or any part of this country, but I, you know, completely could see it and smell it. And, you know, you set the scene of this town so very well. I think that's, well, it's a tribute, obviously, to your writing, but also, you know, having all of these photographs around you and writing from those, I think that's a great idea. I think that's
I knew it was a great setting, and I've always wanted to write a book set in Conneaut, Ohio. I've been going there for almost 40 years now, and it's a fascinating, fascinating part of the country, and I've never seen it in any book or any fiction. I've never seen it somehow, you know, documented or felt. You never get the mood of that anywhere else. And I said, you know, I felt that when I wrote Snow Angels about Western Pennsylvania, you know, sort of Butler, Pennsylvania, that, you know, it's a place where so many people in America live, and yet it's never been written about. So it's kind of it's a wide open field.
Yeah.
And it's fun because you're like, you know, this is such an interesting place to me. I want to get this across to the readers that might not know it. So, I mean, when you're writing, say, New York City, or when you're writing L.A. or Paris or something like that, or even, say, you know, stereotypical farm Midwest, you know, you have all these other models that have already sort of been put out there. So people have these, you know, prejudices against it, or, you know, predispositions. But with Conneaut, Ohio, Kingsville, Ohio, I mean, it's wide open.
Yep.
And the same thing, you know, with Butler, PA, or a lot of the upstate New York books that I've written. It's a part of the country that people just don't think of. And also, I mean, some of the characters, these are people that no one pays any attention to, and no one would think of. I mean, Fran and Ed are as bland as you can possibly come in America. They're just regular people caught up in something that's extraordinary. And those are the kind of...
No, go ahead.
Those are the people that I'm sort of drawn to, the people that, you know, if you ask them to tell you their story, they'd say, you know, I don't have a story.
Yeah.
I don't have anything to say. They're not the people that say, oh, you have to listen about, you know, how I crossed the Sumatran desert, and I was a refugee when I was 7 years old, and I had a Kalashnikov, and, you know, they're not these large figures that come out of, you know, the larger media. They're just regular people. And in this case, they're caught up in this weird story that the media then grabs a hold of. And then Fran has to sort of make that step from being this private person to being a public person. And Ed can't make that step. And no one else wants to make that step. But Fran decides she has to do this. Otherwise, she'll never see her daughter again.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And, the beauty of setting it in that part of the country and with these characters is that, you know, that's 85% or 90% of the country, probably, you know. You're describing the people who never get described, but those are probably the characters that you know, readers can relate to the most.
I always see these people as these are, when I find these people, I say, wow, this is a big story. This is really like Last Night at the Lobster. You know, the manager of a Red Lobster restaurant, and, you know, my agent was like, you know, well, who cares? You know, who cares about, you know, people that work at places like this? Well, I'm like, but there are millions of places like this,
yeah.
Millions of people. This is the story of millions of people. You know, it should be written. You know, we don't have to, not everything has to be sort of glamorous and super politicized, and, you know, it doesn't have to be ripped from the headlines. I mean, it can be just regular, everyday life.
Indeed. Oh, sadly,
but
we've run out.
You know, I'm a provincial novelist, so that's that. I've come to grips with that. I'm definitely a provincial novelist.
Oh, it's
and that's okay.
You're a fabulous novelist. This was such a great read, and such a, like I said, such a quiet novel of kind of, you know, interior thoughts that expressed great truths. It was really beautiful, Stuart. This was such a huge pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much. That was Stuart Onan. His book, Songs for the Missing, is published by Penguin. And that, unfortunately, is all the time we have for today. Barbara will be here next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. with the wonderful Lori Moore. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me, and have a great day. ¶¶